Today's Midrash class, I'll be honest, is going to be less Midrash, although we're going to have a Mahalach, an approach which is in the Midrash, which follows some of the things which we have talked about over the last few weeks. And the two major issues that we need to see and remind ourselves of as background are important before we get into the specific topic of the eulogy for Sarah. Okay, and those two stories are a little earlier in the book of Bereishis. One of them is in Bereishis chapter 16. So if you go back to page 70 in the Chumash, you'll see it. Okay, so if you remember the story, this is before Avram's Bris Milah. The Bris Milah takes place in chapter 17, and this is chapter 16. So the story goes that the war, you know, with Sodom is over. Abraham, not meaning involving Sodom, it wasn't a war against Sodom, but involving Sodom when Abraham saved his nephew Lot, the Bris Bein HaBesarim is passed. It's the covenant between the parts that takes place in chapter 15. And essentially, there we got a significant background to Abraham's, you know, what his MO is, what's driving Abraham. What does he want more than anything? Really, two things that Abraham wants. Abram is looking for the fulfillment of the promise that that God gave him, which is this land is going to be given to your children. And of course, the key ingredient to that promise actually being fulfilled is having children. Okay? So Sarai, Abram's wife, looks at him and says, "All right, you know, I'm barren. That's the end of that's just the reality. But you need to have a child because that was a promise that was given to you from God. And so therefore, I'm willing to forego a little bit of my own covered, a little bit of my own honor, and give you my maid, Hagar, and through her, you'll have a child, and maybe the child will kind of be mine, right, in a way." That's a theme that we see over in the Chumash later, when Rachel and Leah give, not that Leah needs it, but when Rachel and Leah give their maids to Yaakov, they have a similar kind of philosophy. I can't have a child now, so maybe my maid will serve in that place, in that capacity. So, this is Sarai's idea, right? And so what does the Pasuk tell us? Pasuk Gimel, so verse 3, page 70, about 8 lines down. Vatikach Sarai Yesh Zavram Sagar Mitzri Shifasa. Sarai took her maid. Sarai, who Sarai, the wife of Avram, took Hagar, HaMitzri, the Egyptian, Hagar, her maid. Miketz Eser Shanin L'Sheves Avram Eretz Canaan. At the end of 10 years of Avram's living in the land of Canaan. So we're told at the beginning of that parasha Lech Lecha, that Avram was 75 when he left Haran, Avraham ben Chamesh v'shivim shana b'tzeiso me Haran. So the assumption is that he, from the time he left Haran until he got to Canaan, was pretty quick. And now it's 10 years that Avram's living in Canaan, and he has no children. Okay, now what about the little interlude when they went down to Egypt? Good question. When did that take place? Right. So that opens the door to another interesting question, which is the timeline of the Bris Bein HaBesarim. When does that covenant take place? Does it take place, right? And this is something which I discussed in last week's Parsha class on Shabbos, about the discrepancy between the 400 years that are promised to Avram in the Bris Bein HaBesarim, that your children and your descendants are going to be strangers in a strange land for 400 years, which starts when Avram actually has a child, who is the direct line. So that's the 400 years. Whereas in Parshas Bo, we're told that at the end of 430 years, they left Egypt. So where does the 430 years? And just about everybody says that it goes back to the Bris Bein HaBesarim, which assumes that the Bris Bein HaBesarim took place 430 years earlier. But do the math. How old is Avram then at that time? He's 70. But if he's 75 when he leaves Haran, so where does the Bris Bein HaBesarim take place? Does it take place in Canaan? Does it take place within the timeline and the time frame of all the stuff going on with Lot? Or does it take place earlier? Did Avram leave Haran and then go to Canaan, and then go down to Egypt, and then come back to Canaan, and then possibly go back to Haran, and then leave again and come back when he's 75? But there are a lot of open-ended questions. We don't know the answers to these questions, but especially since just about everybody's explanation for the 430 years is that that's actually when the Bris Bein HaBesarim took place. And just do the simple math and see that Avram has to be 70 at that time. So there's a little bit of confusion because it's unclear. All right, anyway, so but the assumption is that Avram 75 when he gets to Canaan and stays in Canaan, which again throws a little monkey wrench into his going down to Egypt when there's a famine. So now Avram is 85. But we know that this is true because the Pasuk is actually going to tell us at the very end of this that when he takes Hagar, he's 85, yes, and when Yishmael is born, which is, you know, not a year later, but 9 months later, let's say, how old is he? 86. It's the very last pasuk of the chapter. If you don't believe me, there's no reason not to believe me, but if you don't believe me, page 72, pasuk designed, Avram ben shonim shana v'shei shanim. He's 86 years old, but let us Hagar as Yishmael Avram. Okay, the Torah tells us that. So that's just in terms of timeline. Now, go back to pasuk Dalid. After Sarai gives Hagar to Avram, her husband, I love that, Le'avram isha, lo li'isha, to Avram, her man, right? The dot in the hay, at the first word in the line where it says a dalet, isha means her man, lo li'isha, to him as a wife. So Hagar is a wife. She's not a concubine, she's not a maid, she's a wife, okay, which is important for other purposes. We're not going to get into that now. Vayavoel Hagar v'tahar, right? He comes to Hagar in the biblical sense, and she becomes pregnant. Vatera kiarasa, when she sees that she is pregnant, vatekal gavirta be'ineha. So her mistress becomes basically denigrated in her eyes, right? You loser, you've been married to him for at least 10 years, if not more. No children, 10 years in this land, if not more. No children, I married him for 2 seconds, boom, I'm pregnant. You're such a loser. Okay? Not very nice, granted, but what does it mean? Vatekal gavirta be'ineha. So does that mean that she was giving Sarai, you know, looks that made Sarai uncomfortable? Did she actually say something? Okay, we don't know. We only know an emotion, which is expressed here. Vatekal gavirta be'ineha. It could have been subtle. It could have been almost nothing. It could have been like, you know, Hagar up until now is singing one tune, and now that she's pregnant, she's like, wow, I'm really special. And that is, and so she's singing a different melody now when she's humming and mopping the floor. And maybe Sarai takes it the wrong way. I mean, we don't know, because we don't see Hagar actually doing anything. We just see the Torah saying, Vatekal gavirta be'ineha, that which our scroll translates, her mistress was lowered in her esteem. Okay? That's not, doesn't, might not even have been an action, right? It's just in her mind. But who gets all hissy about it? You know, maybe legitimately so. Sarai gets all upset. And she says, Vatomer Sarai el Avram chamosi alecha, right? She says, I don't have the time. I once gave a class about this. I think I did last year. I think it was the Aksavah Kabbalah class. It was fascinating, which you could probably find in the YU Torah. You have to look for last year's class on Parshas Lech Lecha. Vatomer Sarai El Avram Chamasi El Lecha. Which essentially means like, actually, you know what? One of the arguments that he made is that the word Chamasi does not mean anger. Okay? Because what's the word which means anger? Chema. Ches mem hei. And when you say my anger, look at Megillas Esther. B'chamaso ba'aravo. Ches mem saf, right? See here, it's ches mem samach. What's ches mem samach? It's the word chamas. Right? What's chamas? Right? Chamas is the reason for the flood. That's what the Torah tells. Vatimalei aretz chamas. So what, I mean, how does the article translate it? It says, the outrage against me is due to you. Not such a great translation. Hamas, right? The violence against me, the inequity that's being delivered on me. Alecha, it's on you, Abraham. Okay, in other words, the way that I'm being treated as a result is on you, because you could have nipped this in the bud. You could have said, "Hey, Hagar, you know this is really all Sarai's doing. It's not my idea." And remember, if things work out the way that this is all planned, there's gratitude to Sarai, which is supposed to come. Maybe that's where Sarai is coming from. Okay, we're not. I don't want to get too stuck in that, but just to show you that there is more depth than, you know, I'm anger or I'm angry or the anger against me. Okay, anyway. I gave my maid to you, right? Now she sees she's pregnant, and I'm lowered in her eyes. Yishpot Hashem b'ini u'b'inecha. Let God be the judge between you and between me and between you. Avram's response, take her and do what you want with her, she's yours. And so Sarai is not very nice. Sarai at the end of Pasuk Vav, the end of the next line, and Hagar runs away. Okay, so now this story is not a very nice story. And the truth is that the commentaries are very critical of both Sarai and Avram for the way they treat Hagar here, because it's really not a nice story. I mean, Hagar is she's a pawn. She's just a chess piece in this story, and while she's meant to be the help, I don't want to call her the savior. That's the wrong word. But she's meant to, you know, kind of be the saving grace for Avram, who really has given up. I don't want to say he's given up on hope. Okay, he hasn't. Maybe Avram hasn't given up hope because he really wants to have a child with Sarai, and that's what the next chapter, the Bris Mila, is all about. That he's told over and over again, Sarai ishtecha, you let us lechaben. Sarai, your wife, is going to be giving birth to a child for you. So it's not. I don't think it's fair to say that Avram has given up hope. But Sarai is the one who says, look, here's my reality. I mean, I know the way my body's working. I'm not getting pregnant. Okay, so here's Hagar. So there are ways to possibly make it that, assuming that Hagar gets pregnant, because that was the plan, that the net result and the way that everybody would be treated would be nicer. And that didn't happen. But what's Sarai's response? She says, God should judge between you and me. Okay, what does that mean? What does that mean? Okay, so again, Avram, not so good in this story, though maybe a little better than Sarai. Sarai is really hammered for her behavior in this story. Okay.
Interesting. Sorry, my uncle uses the word b'chamasi. He says din li. No, it's din. He says that chamasi means din li, that this judgment
right.
that's upon me is because of you, Avram.
Okay, so, but...
I don't know if Thomas has ever used that din in any other.
Din li Allah. Right. And I have what's she saying? Din li Allah. Like
my
judgment.
My judgment should be on
right. Me. Yeah. Okay, so and again, what does it mean? Is it that my judgment as in I'm the judge and jury, or my judgment as in the judgment that's been against me? Okay. Anyway, yeah, exactly. So that's a different topic, but it's really the line of Yishpor Hashem b'nei Benecha, which is the first piece of the background that we're looking at today. The second piece of background is what I believe was last week's topic, and our last week's topic was the age of people at the Akedah. So if you go back to the end of last week's parsha. The end of last week, I'm sorry, the end of Parshas Vayera, we find that page 104, okay? This is the Akedah, the binding of Yitzchak, and the story of the binding of Yitzchak is, here, there's a Chumash on page here. The story of the binding of Yitzchak concludes, of course, with Abraham not killing Yitzchak, and with the very last line is, in the Akedah part, is on page 104, right before that little break in the middle of the page, which is by Yashav Avraham el Ne'arav, Avraham returned to his lads. By Yakumu they got up. By Yachu Yachdav el Be'er Shava they returned to Be'er Shava. By Yeshav Avraham Be'er Shava and Avraham settles in Be'er Shava. Okay. Now, by the way, just as an aside, there is it's an interesting study. Most people probably don't really care. But there's a distinction that I have found between Be'er Sheva and Be'er Shava. Okay, so some and the reason is given to the both of the names. One is on account of a shvua, which Avram makes a swear, which Avram makes with Avimelech, and the other one is on account of the seventh well and a well named Shiva, which Yitzchak agrees to with Avimelech, which might be a different Avimelech if Avimelech is like. You know, the Gerar equivalent of Pharaoh in Egypt, okay, which is very likely the case. So anyway, Be'er Shava, so we'll leave that for what it is. But Avram goes back there. Okay? So that's the background. And where's Yitzchak? So we discussed that last week. I'm not gonna repeat last week's class. Yitzchak is not present. The very next Psukim introduces us to Avram's brother's Nahor's family, Avram's brother Nahor's family. Which includes a mention of Rivka. That's Pasuk Chaf Beis, verse 22. Uvesuel Yaladas Rivka. Right? And then Avram hears about the birth of all of these kids. Not only these kids, but Besuel, who is one of Nahor's sons, is now a father himself. So in other words, Avram's getting a whole family tree, which must have spanned years that it was developed. And Rivka seems to be the last in that family tree for now. Note, by the way, that Lavan isn't mentioned. Like, what's that all about? If Rivka is born, And we assume, I believe that we actually know, that Lavan is an older brother, right? Lavan's an older brother. Ulu Rivka Achu Shmo Lavan. Lavan comes out and greets Avram's servant and says to him, hey, come on into the house. So that's the background that we have. Lavan, for whatever reason, is not mentioned. And so what does everybody say? Oh, the whole reason for mentioning Nachor's family is so that we know about Rivka. Okay? And why? Because it means that Rivka was just born. Now, I tried to prove last week that Rivka was not just born. Okay? And that the Akedah took place earlier than the age that Rashi and others ascribe. We saw the different viewpoints last week. But that viewpoint that says that the Akedah took place at the same time as the birth of Yitzchak also says that, turn the page, page 106, that the years of Sarah's life, 127, that all this takes place in the same, you know, time frame. That Sarah's death at age 127 was the same time as Rivka's birth and was the same time as the Akedah. And so, since we're given the age of Sarah at this time, which is 127, that means, since we know that she was 90 when Yitzchak was born, that Yitzchak is 37, and that Rivka, if she's born at this time, she's zero. And so when Yitzchak gets married in Parshas Toldos, or I mean, he gets married at the end of Chayisara, but his age is told us in Parshas Toldos, that Yitzchak is 40 when he gets married. That's the source for the idea that Rivka is three at the time of their marriage. And that's actually the next class. Okay, the next class we're going to look at Rivka's age. And that next class is not next week, because next week it's not scheduled on account of the yeshiva break. But we'll meet the next Thursday. Okay, the next Thursday after that. Okay, so anyway, that's the background. We have the Akedah, and therefore Sarah's Yitzchak being 37, and Avram basically coming from the Akedah to bury Sarah. Now, another problem in that approach is that where does Avram go after the Akedah? Beersheba, right? Beersheba. We just saw that. Beersheba. And what does it say? Vatama Sarah, Pasuk Beis, page 106, second line. Vatama Sarah, where does Sarah die? Be'keriyat Arba. Hi Chevron. That's not Beersheba. Be'eretz Kanan Vayavo Avram Uspildu Sarah V'liv Kosa. Okay? So Avram comes to eulogize Sarah V'liv Kosa and to cry. Now take a look at the word V'liv Kosa and to cry, and you'll see that the Art Scroll will note for you very, very, very clearly two things. Number one, there's a star in the middle of that, and that's showing you on the right side, Chaf Zeira. Chaf Zeira means there's a small Chaf here, and guess what they even did to prove it? In the word, they put a small chaf. Okay? And that's our topic today. Vayavo Avraham l'spod l'sara v'liv kosa. Now, we see nothing about Sarah's eulogy. We don't know what he says. Because immediately after, we're told that Avram came with spod l'sarah to give a eulogy for Sarah, the liv kosa, and to cry for her. Then he starts dealing with Ephron to buy the maras mapela, right, to buy the burial plot for his wife. All we see is that Avram came to eulogize and Avram came to cry. Okay, that's it. And there's this little chaf in the word liv kosa to cry for her, which, as anybody who knows anything about these little subtleties in the Torah, if there's a big letter or a small letter, that's a call to attention. And that means we need to figure out what's going on over here. The Torah is trying to tell us something. Now, there is an approach that I believe I saw in the Midrash that if you get rid of the letter Chaf, what word do you have there? Ulevita. Right? The word of Avram. Avram came to eulogize Sarah and Bita, which stands to suggest one of at least two possibilities. One is that Sarah was pregnant at the time, which is crazy, okay, with a girl, but because Sarah died, the girl didn't make it, which is crazy. And the other one is that she had a daughter, but that we didn't hear about in the Torah, and there's a whole thing about that, that Avram, Hashem Berachas Avram Bakol, that God blessed Avram Bakol, and what's Bakol? Bakol is the name of his daughter, and whatever happened to her, okay? Totally different, so I'm not even going there. Okay, but that's just something to throw out there. That's an approach that says that the chaf, you know, is thrown in there, you know, to give us a digression, to throw us off. Okay, the chaf is in there to throw us off. But on a literal level, of course, v'liv kosa means and to cry for her. Okay? And so that's where we're at. That's where we're at. And so what we're going to do now is we're going to move from the Chumash to the sheet which I gave you. And the sheet is loose, in some cases loosely translated. And as I said at the outset, while this is officially a Midrash class, today it's inspired by Midrash, okay, more than anything else. These are really commentaries on this Pasuk. And while some of it is pretty straightforward, we do get into the realm of some Kabbalistic ideas, which I'll be honest and upfront, I do not completely understand. There was one commentary that I had here, which I actually eliminated completely because I was reading it again. I was like, I don't, you know what? I can't even present this. I don't know what he's talking about. So we'll do what we have here, and we'll take away a few different lessons in terms of Avram and Sarah's relationship. We will also walk away with a few possibilities as to what the Chaf is trying to teach us in terms of how to understand the Sarah story. Okay? Okay, so let's go through this. Vayavo Avraham v'spod l'Sarah v'liv kosa. Okay? That Chaf Kitana, l'fi ha'pshad z'keina yusav lo bachu osa kol kach. The first pshad is that, this is the Rush, who says that there's a Chaf, a small Chaf, because she was an old lady, an old lady. We recently had this, somebody in the shul, his mother was 103, and she passed away. Okay, you know, very nice, nice long life. And at the funeral, was there pain? There's always pain at a funeral, right? We're going to miss the person. But it wasn't the same as like a 50-year-old or a 20-year-old. Right? 103, thank God, a very long life. So that's the point that, that's the first point that we're being told here. A small chav, you know, you're not crying as much, right? Especially if somebody, you know, in the case that I just mentioned, the woman in question had, I don't know exactly what it was, but some, you know, dementia or whatever it may have been. And so the family had been crying for years already, which sometimes lo aleinu happens. And so, but still, again, not minimizing the pain and the loss, but that's what he's saying. The chav is because the cry was not as big a cry as you normally get at a death. That's the first one. V'liv kosa, the Baal Turim says, Chav Ketana, he basically quotes the same idea that the Rush said. Shalo bacha el miyat lefesh zkeina haisa. Okay? They didn't cry too much because she was old. Inami, and here's the part where their translation comes in. Shahaisa kamo goremes misasa shemusra din. Okay, now he's referencing the story that we started with, which is the way that Sarai related to Abraham after they became aware that Hagar was pregnant. That what did she do? Yishpot Hashem b'ini v'necha. God should judge between me and you, Sarai said to her husband Avram. She caused her own death through bringing down judgment. And therefore, Al-Kain en shahit chila, she was punished first. What did she do? She said, on her husband who was a tzaddik, right, the one to whom she said, Avram, I want to do this for you. I want this for you. And all of a sudden, Hagar becomes pregnant, and she starts yelling at Avram as if this is his fault. Hold on, Sarai. Yeah, I mean, we know, we understand the birds and the bees, right? We know how Hagar got pregnant. But we also know how Hagar got into Avram's bed in the first place. Right? Who did that? You did that. So how are you blaming Avram? He did what you told him to do. So this isn't an Avram problem. This isn't your problem. And then you're coming along and saying, Yishpot Hashem b'ni v'necha, God should judge between me and you. Guess what God does? God judges. And God says, Sarai, you brought this upon yourself, and you're asking for judgment because of what you did? So yeah, your punishment comes against you. And that was one of the arguments which I made last week, which is the possibility that Sarah died, I'm just going to use the word early, okay? And I gave the whole cheshbon last week of what it means that she died early, but that Sarah died early, not because of dying from the shock from the Akedah, okay, which is certainly an approach that Chazal, that the rabbis have, but there's a whole line of thinking that says that Sarai/Sarah lost years of her life on account of that statement that she said to Abraham. Okay, and we're going to see a little bit more soon, but understand that the Baal Turim, he's just the tip of the iceberg, saying that she brought this upon herself, so much so that he's viewing her halachically like a person who is ma'abid atzmo ladas. What's ma'abid atzmo ladas? Somebody who commits suicide, but not commit suicide, knowingly commits suicide. Okay? By the way, that's just a fascinating thing about how psychology has changed a very clear halacha. Once upon a time, the halacha is very clear. Somebody who is ma'abed atzmo l'das, which means somebody who kills oneself l'das, knowingly, right, which basically means I'm of sound mind and sound body, I know exactly what I'm doing, right? You don't eulogize, you don't, and there are a lot of halachas in terms of how you go about burying or how you deal with the person. Do you do a tahara? Do you do shiva? I mean, there are a lot of discussions about this. Nowadays, what do we say about anybody who commits suicide? That they're not lida'as, that there's depression, that they're, right, they're not responsible. They're not coming from a place of like knowing. Something else was playing with their mind. So we say, no, there's no such thing as ma'abed atzmo lida'as anymore. Nobody commits suicide understanding the repercussions of what they're doing. Okay, that's what psychology has changed halacha completely. Completely. Okay, and so, but what's Sarai doing? She's saying, I know, what the Baal Turim is saying rather is that Sarai knew what she was doing, and she knew that she was at fault, so to speak. Again, not that there's fault here, but she knew that this whole thing happened because of her, and yet she's saying to Avraham, God should judge between you and me. Hold on, sir. Really? We all know. Look at the story. We all know whose fault this is. If you have to point fingers, it's your fault, Sarai. So you're saying God should judge? You're ma'abed atzmo l'das. You're calling this upon yourself. You knew what was going on. It's not like Avraham said to Sarai, you know, I really want to have a child. Hey, you know, there's a lady in the next room. Right? That wasn't Avraham's idea. Sarah said, you really want to have a child. Hey, there's a lady in the next room. No, that's the maid. I'm not interested. No, Avraham, it's a good idea. I agree with it. I support it. Actually, it's my idea. Well, das, you totally know. So that's the Baal Turim's critique. And again, he's just touching on the iceberg. Okay, now there are other approaches. Okay? Yaksavi HaKabbalah, he says the following. Crying usually comes before the eulogy. Okay, again, this is my translation. It should have said that he cried and then he eulogized. But since crying demonstrates the pain over the loss of the deceased, and the eulogy is stories of praise, so everyone will feel the loss. And he says, "V'tzadikim ein roi l'vkosim itzaraf yisasam ki gidolim yisasam yosemi b'chayehem." With the righteous, it's not worth crying in the same way, because they become even greater when they die. Right? Think about this. There are, and this happens, by the way. It happens all the time. It happens with politicians. I was reading some of the things that were written about John McCain this year when he passed away. There are people, you know. Actually, both the Democrat side and the Republican side, who hated John McCain, b'chayev, right, in his lifetime, right? Inflated. Saying whatever, you know, I mean, listen, definitely he was a long-time senator, okay, you know, certainly dedicated his life post, you know, his public life to public service, by all means. But people who in his life hated him, but because he was critical of Trump in the last couple of years of his life, all of a sudden he became a saint. Okay, and there are people who have their wits about them and say, wait a second, the guy dies, all of a sudden he's a saint, you hated him your whole life. Like, why, or his whole life, why did you, you know? So you have to be aware that this is what happens. It happens to anybody. It could happen to anybody who, once they die, they become a saint. And so, with the righteous, he says, with tzaddikim, it's not worth crying because they become even greater when they die. And this is why her eulogy came first. Avram had to do a hesped, a eulogy, to show that the crying over her was for those who are left behind. In other words, you know, she was a gedola. She was really amazing in her lifetime. Now that she's dead, she's like a malach, right? She's an angel. And so for all of us who are now hearing this, we're realizing, oh my goodness, what have we lost? What's here? Like we're she's so incredibly amazing now, getting bigger and bigger and bigger in our eyes as the hesped, as the eulogy drags on. What do we now realize? We're not crying because she died. Her death is, for her, she's now with God, right? Most amazing. Why do we cry now? Because we feel the loss ever so much more. We didn't even realize what we had until it's gone. Okay, and that's what happens when the great ones pass. We say, oh my goodness, what have we lost? We didn't appreciate it as much as we should have in our lifetimes. Or maybe we did, but now we realize with their loss. I think about like when Rav Moshe Feinstein passed away. Think about when Rav Ovadia Yosef passed away. I mean, you know, funeral like you've never seen. I heard a comparison that was made. When Rav Ovadia passed away, for example, he had somewhere, the estimates were between 800,000 to a million people at his funeral. Where, and how much in Jerusalem. And how much time passes from when he passed away until his funeral? mean, no time. They bury right away. So imagine how quick. JFK, who was assassinated, we know that story, and his funeral took place. How many people were at his funeral? Weeks later. How many people were at his funeral? 800,000. Rav Avadia and JFK. Okay? Now, the circumstances behind JFK's murder were just, I mean, so traumatic and tragic, of course. Rav Avadia was certainly an older man and had lived a full life. Okay? But if you look at the stats of those two things, which is more impressive? Okay? In a country of 8 million, that 10% of the population shows up within 3 hours. Versus a country of, I don't know how many millions were in the country at the time, okay, and they had weeks to prepare, or however much time, and same number of people. I mean, come on, there's no comparison, with all due respect to the president, okay, and the tragic circumstances surrounding his death, but, I mean, Rav Avadia wipes the floor, with all due respect, okay, so...
Who was the other one that you mentioned besides that rabbit? Who was the other rabbit?
JFK, oh, Rav Moshe Feinstein in the 80s, right, in the 80s.
How many people did he have?
I don't know. We don't have to play that game. I'm just, you know, I had that number recently because Rav Avadia passed away in the last few years. Whereas Rav Moshe, I was a kid at the time, so I don't remember those stats. Anyway.
You can probably look it up.
Yeah, you can look it up. Okay. Anyway, but the crying over her was for those who were left behind. This is why there's a small chaf. Okay, so in other words, another viewpoint as to why there's a small chaf is not so much because there's little crying, but it's because there needs to be crying for those who need to cry, but it's not like such a big cry because she's elevated so much more, she becomes ever so much greater. Okay, that's the Aksav Ekabal. Now, the Kli Yakar goes into a different arena in discussing this because he starts talking about Kabbalistic ideas about where the soul goes and things of that nature. He talks about the Chaf Nachas and the Chaf Akela, which refer to different, I'll just call them holding zones, where the soul goes to after death. I don't understand it. I don't know that stuff. I'm not a Kabbalist. So I'm going to skip the first paragraph and I'm going to go to the second paragraph. Davar acher sheramaz b'chaf ktana shemesa b'itav shel nachash. Hey, that there is the reason for the small chaf is to show that she died on account of the snake. What do you mean account of the snake? When we think about the nachash, what's the nachash? The snake is the serpent in the Garden of Eden. Gan Eden. Right? And what is it? what's the snake's... what's the snake's role in death? That the snake essentially brought mortality to the world. When the human beings, Adam and Chava, were in the Garden of Eden, they were prohibited from eating from one tree, the Eitz Hadas, the tree of knowledge. They were not prohibited from eating from another tree in the garden called the Eitz HaChaim, the tree of life. And the rule of, I mean, not the rule, in other words, a natural law that came with the Eitz HaChaim is that if you eat from the tree, and if you're allowed to eat from every other tree in the garden, eventually you're going to eat from the Eitz HaChaim, even if you don't know which tree it is. And it's very possible that they didn't know which tree it was. So if you eat from the tree of life, you live forever, right? That's when they get thrown out of the garden, we're told that there's a flaming sword and the path is blocked so they can't go back into the Garden of Eden. Why? L'shmor es derech Eitz HaChaim, to guard the path to that tree of life. Why? Because if they can get back to the tree of life, then they can eat from the tree of life, and they can live forever. So
But why make a connection between Sarah and the snake in Gan Eden? There was so much time in between.
No, because we're talking about the concept of mortality. Okay? And the concept of mortality was introduced to the world because of the snake, because the snake caused them to eat from the tree, and eating from the tree caused them to be expelled from the garden. And once they're expelled from the garden, there's no more immortality. Right. It's mortality. So he says that the small chaf is bringing... Because theoretically, if you're going to say that Sarah, for example, is such a tzaddikas, that she's so holy, so righteous, she should have lived forever. But no, she doesn't live forever. Why? Because nobody lives forever. Why does nobody live forever? Mm-hmm. Because of the nachash.
And the chaf represents a 20 years.
So let's get there. So we're going to get there. Okay? Okay, so now, here's where you get into like the way the Midrash manipulates and teaches. That Adam was created, Mikzeh HaShemayim Ad Katzeyu. What is Mikzeh HaShemayim? That when Adam was first made, he was, you know, he was able to reach from the heavens to the heavens. In other words, that's how big he was. But when he's thrown out of the garden, his stature was diminished. Okay, in other words, he wasn't whatever size he had been before, whatever capability, whatever capacity he had before, he was diminished. And on account of the sin of the snake, he became smaller. Mea Amma, what's Mea Amma? 100 cubits. Again, I don't completely understand what this means. What, he was 100 cubits tall? Is that what it means? That's impossible. Okay? But Shenemar, Vatasha Salai Kafcha. That's a pasuk in Tehillim Kuf Lamites, which I should have looked up, but I did not. But he says, what's Chaf? Vatasha Salai, that what's upon me is Chafcha. What's Chafcha? Chaf, Hainu Mea. The gematria, the numerical value of the word chaf, which is chaf and fei, chaf is 20, fei is 80, is 100. Ulfishin ismayed uhamad amaspar chaf, because he was diminished, and he basically was diminished down to the equivalent of the letter chaf, meyaz nechash kocho v'nasamuchan lamisa. Okay, the point is that the small chaf is an indicator of the concept of man, meaning mankind, being diminished, and therefore being subject to mortality. So the little chaf is showing, why is Avram coming, lispod l'sarah, to eulogize her and to cry for her? Because she's mortal. And that is something which people needed to understand, that even somebody as great as Sarah could die. She is mortal. And that's what's being hinted to with the small chaf. Okay? All right, I'm going to skip the Sefer HaTodah. I mean, he says, if you don't cry for someone who is kosher, then one has to pay for three chafs. What the chafs are, chaf refuya means... that's the letter chaf without a dot. Chaf degusha means a chaf with a dot, what we would call a chaf. And chaf arucha means a final chaf. Again, I don't really know what that means, but I saw him using the small letter chaf and thought that maybe somebody else does. But chaf is something which needs to be paid for, but that's hinted to with a small chaf. Okay, let's move on to the Perish Bali at Tosfos Abrashis. Okay. So here he says, "Vayevo Avram l'spod." Avram came to give a eulogy. Why did Avram come to give a eulogy? Because 3 days had already passed since she died, and Avram eulogized her during those days. And afterwards he cried. Okay, so remember, Avram after the Akedah he goes to Beersheba. Sarah dies in Kiryat Arba, which means that Avram and Sarah were not in the same place when he died. When she died, rather. Why were they in different places? Fascinating question. I saw an idea, I was first introduced to this idea in Joseph Telushkin's book. I think it was Biblical Literacy, although it may have been Jewish Literacy, where he introduces an idea, a Kabbalistic idea, that Avram and Sarah separated over the incident of the Akedah, that Sarah did not trust Avram anymore with their son, and she said, "We're not going to live together anymore." Which is crazy, but wow, what a fascinating idea! And that, and of course, that goes back to the idea that I mentioned earlier, that the Akedah took place prior to Yitzchak being 37, and that she didn't die from the shock. And again, that idea that she dies on account of her years being diminished because of the way she spoke to Avram also supports the idea that she dies at 127 for other reasons, not having anything to do with the Akedah. So what do we have here? Avram hears about his death, right? And now he says, okay, I'm going to go. I gotta take care of business. Okay, regardless of whatever their relationship was, let's assume that they were married. They just weren't in the same place. 3 days passed. Avram does a hesped, a eulogy, and then he cries, and that's why we have a small chaf in the word livchosa, to say eino chay livchos ishto ela me'at me'at, because a person does not need to cry except for a little bit for his wife. Okay, now that's a crazy idea. Right? There are some people who, I'm not going to say what some people are. Okay, well, that's what it is. But how can you tell a person how much you have to cry for one's spouse? How can you tell a person? For some people, their spouse is their life. And especially after being together for 50, 60, 70 years, which, thank God, some people are blessed to have. You know, I mean, when the spouse is gone, they're besides themselves, because they don't know what to do with themselves. Like, this has been my life partner for so long. I don't know how to live without this person. So to say you can only cry a little bit, you know, I don't. I mean, I'm not really even sure what to make of that. Okay, so that's one explanation that the Baalei Tosfos are giving for what the small chaf is indicating. Another explanation, Perush Acher, A small chaf, chaf l'chav tana l'fi shechas meimei chaf shana. So here he gets this idea that she has 20 years less mima shechai ben bina, from that which her grandson lived, which was 147. Right? Who's that?
Yaakov.
V'hi chaysa kuf chav zayin chas v'chaf meimeha chaf miyameha l'fi shemas radin al avin ensha. Okay, so there is a whole idea. So what does that mean? That because of the way she treated Abraham, her years were lessened by 20 from the lowest number of years of, in this case, her grandson. So last week I mentioned that there is an idea which is floated around in the Midrash that Abraham, that the Avos and the Imahos, or at least Sarah, Rivka lived a long time. Rachel and Leah probably lived much less. But they were all supposed to live to the same realm of age. Okay, the Avos are supposed to live to 180, and the Imahos were either supposed to live to 180 or die in the same year that their husbands died. Okay? Something like that. Avram lives to 175. Why? Everybody says, so you shouldn't see Esav go in a bad direction. Yitzchak lives to 180. Yaakov lives to 147. Why? They say that Yaakov lost 33 years of his life. Different possibilities because of the way he spoke to Paro, and Paro asked him how old he is, and other possibilities as well. Okay, so fine. But in other words, Yaakov also lost years of his life, and so his years were 147. Sarah dies at 127. So he's saying that she should have at least lived to be as old as her grandson, right? Because he lost only 33 years from 180. She should have at least lived to that. Nope. So she lost even from that 20 years, and that's what the Chaf is coming to teach us. And, you know, I don't understand these ideas. What? Because of something that somebody said, they lose years of their life? But what's he trying to show us is, so even if you don't want to say causality, you just want to show that the Torah is hinting and indicating, yeah, Sarah, you know, she didn't, look, you know, there's supposed to be a connection here in terms of the number of years that she should have lived, but she didn't. And so the Chaf is showing us that there's that difference of 20 years. Okay, possible. That's the Balatosis. But again, what's he hanging that on? The way Sarah talked and spoke to Abraham. Okay, and last week I mentioned that there are different possibilities in terms of how many years she actually may have lost, in terms of Yishpor HaShebeg Yubeinecha, what that could have been, that she lost from either, the, you know, whether it was, I don't think anybody says that she was actually supposed to live to 180, but she was either supposed to live the number of years that Avram lived, 175, which would mean that she lost 48 years, or she was supposed to live to be 170, because Avram was supposed to live to 180, which means that she lost 43 years, or she was supposed to live to be, 43 years. Or she was supposed to live to be 165, to die the same year that Avram died, which meant that since he died 175, she was supposed to die at 165, which would mean that she lost 38 years. There are all bunch of different cheshbonos in order to get to these numbers and how they explain the way Sarah died. Okay. But again, it's connected to what she said in the story of Hagar. Last one, on this side of the page, Sefer Toldos Yitzchak. Aram's joy was so great when he came from the land of Moriah with Yitzchak being alive. So this is why we looked at the Akedah, to show you that he's assuming that Sarah dies on account of the news of the Akedah, right? And so therefore, Abram was so happy that Yitzchak was alive that even though Sarah died, he didn't have the ability to cry until after he had eulogized her and told the story of her life. He should cry first, but Abram comes to her funeral and he's so happy that Yitzchak's alive. He's like, she died. Tragedy. But I can't believe it. Yitzchak's alive. It's unbelievable. Yitzchak, I thought he was going to die too. But he didn't. Yitzchak's alive. And so therefore, I'm so elated. I can't even think about this. All right, I got to talk. I got to give a eulogy. I'll give a eulogy. He gives the eulogy. He talks about Sarah. And as he's talking, he gets all emotionally worked up and all bent over. And he realizes, oh my God, my wife died. So then he cries. He cries a little bit. Because why? Does he only cry a little bit? Because, all right, I can't believe she's gone. But Yitzchak's alive! I can't get over it! So it's a little bit of a cry, and that's the viewpoint that the Toldos Yitzchak has in this perspective. And so that's, again, what the little chaf is trying to indicate to us about the husband. Does Avram eulogize Sarah? Yeah, everybody seems to be in agreement that his eulogy of Sarah really brings out her essence, and it talks about her, and it shows the loss, and it makes people feel it. But there's, you know, there's another side to whatever's going on here. Okay, turn over the page. Just a thought that I found in the Be'er Mayim Chaim, and on this as well. So the first part is more Kabbalistic, as is the second part, but I think we'll try to tackle it anyway. Okay, so look at the part which is in bold. Echishu b'nei beis Avram Eliezer chadameh asara kolkach mishum yikra the Avraham ki ech yeechad miskabe b'kolon chaveiro chalila shmishum kvodo yameis b'bizayon. Okay, so the question is, how does Avraham, the people in Avraham's household, Eliezer, etc., how do they leave Sarah? You know, they should have found a way, I guess he's saying, to bury her. How could anybody be honored when Avraham's b'kolon chavera, when Avraham's so destroyed? L'zeh amar Sarah gufa nichala. Ki vada im rab mosim tshuva al yidei bech yameis, vada ishi tova gam meis, kem zakas rab, zechus rab talibo. The fact that they didn't bury Sarah right away is because of the crying which took place, because the crying which took place takes place over the death of a righteous person, is something which is misorer tshuva, right? It inspires people to return to God when they think about what the loss at hand is, and they make commitments to be better. So Avram didn't need tshuva, he's such a tzaddik, right? But for everybody else, there is merit to Sarah's burial being delayed until Avram shows up to give the eulogy. Now, how long did it take from the time that Sarah died until Avram showed up? Right, we have no idea. I mean, he had to get a telegram first, or at least somebody needed to tell him. But yeah.
You said Avram made it to 175 because he wasn't happy with the direction.
Not him. In other words, the way that the rabbis explained it was that Esav and Yaakov, who were twins, were 15 at that time. And because Esav was basically going to go off in a bad direction, God took Abraham so that he shouldn't see that. Okay, the Pasuk says about Abraham, Vayechi Abraham, it's at the end of Parashat Chayisara. It's an amazing line, which we only find about, I think it's said about Abraham and Adam. About Abraham and Adam. That Ela Shnei Chaye Avraham Asher Chai. These are the names. These are the years, rather, of Avraham's life that he lived. Okay, what do you mean that he lived? Everybody lives the life that they live, and then you die. And one interpretation that I saw is that Avraham, the years of Avraham's life that he lived were 175, but he didn't live those last 5 years because he died. Okay, and Adam, same idea. How long was Adam supposed to live? 1,000 years. Adam lives 930. So I believe at Adam it also says that the years that Adam lived, Asher Chai, that he lived of his life, were 930. But the other years,
he's supposed to have 1,000,
right? Right. They were given the David HaMelech, died, whatever it is. Okay, but that he only lived a certain number of what were supposed to be his years, which I believe you only find by Avram and Adam. Anyway, so that's that point. The Odef Shalomar B'Tama Chavzira. So now we get back to brass tacks, right? Why a small chav? That Sarah was to Avram besod. What's sod? When you hear the word sod, you have to start thinking Kabbalistically. Okay, so I'm not going to go there. I don't know, but that she was his eishes chayel ateret, the crown of her husband. Baala nisater ba vihilo nisatera. Her husband was crowned by her, and she was not crowned by him. You know why? Because we all know. Who's the Akeres Abayis, right? Every married man will tell you that I'm nothing without my wife. That's what every married man says. And maybe sometimes they're joking, but they really mean it. V'amru, shayatafel eleha b'nevius, that he was secondary to her. She was a greater prophet than Avram was. But he was crowned by her. V'yado asod b'zeh liodei razeh Eloheinu, and those who understand the secrets of God, is barak shmo b'sod dalid Vav partzufim. Again, I don't understand the Kabbalistic ideas. Sha dalad she nukva kodemes alavav. The dalad comes before the vav. She dchora v'nodash hakasuv romez al keser she ateres teferes. That what the pasuk is doing here, it's giving us a hint to the crown, which is the crown of glory. Now Cain kasher mesa Sarah, and therefore when Sarah died, bo Avram lizkosa. Avram came to cry for her. She avar atar me al roshu because he had lost his crown. Because she was the crown for her husband. And he says, that's why the chaf is written small. Balamar ki zeh ayah b'chiyah shelo. He was crying, sheniskate in kisro, because his crown was diminished. Shayi misater b'sara. What is the chaf? The chaf stands for the keser. Avram had a crown. Avram was Avram, right? Everybody looked to Avram. And then Sarah dies, and Avram becomes little Avram. Avram, because he loses his crown. And how do we know he loses his crown? Because he becomes a nobody in the story. I'm not denigrating Avram. Chalil v'chas. But why can't Avram go and take care of finding a wife for Yitzchak? Why does he have to send somebody else? You're Avram Avinu. You've done everything in your life. Why can't you do this? And then he goes ahead and he marries Keturah, and it's like a nothing story. He marries Keturah. He's got six boys with her. And then it's nothing. Avram is, you know, he's just, all of Avram's stories are over at this point in time. Why? Because Sarah's dead. And so essentially what the little chaf is showing us is how Abraham's status is tempered, in a sense, on account of the fact that his wife Sarah, who raised him, meaning elevated him, was gone. And that's hinted and indicated in the small chaf, because Avram's crown, Avram's chaf, Avram's keser, his crown is lost, or certainly at the very least diminished. And on account of that, Avram becomes a relatively ordinary citizen after this point. So essentially what we get from all this is that there are different strains and different thought processes in terms of why Sarah dies. But in the end, the chaf is showing us a whole bunch of different ideas about the way we are to view Sarah's death in terms of her being old, and therefore maybe not to cry so much, because she was such a tzadegas. Avram personally crying less because of Yitzchak's being alive. Avram crying a little less or Avram's stature being lessened on account of the loss of the crown, or Avram just crying because, you know, not really sure what to make of this idea of mortality and where Sarah fits into the scheme of things. What's Avram's proper reaction? But in the end, I think that Sarah her status is elevated. There is so much to be said about the 120 and 7 that a number of the commentaries in the Midrash focus on. But in the end, we just have to feel the loss of Sarah Imenu at that time, and what it meant for Abraham, what it meant for Yitzchak, and how it, you know, in a sense, changed the trajectory of the stories of their lives when Sarah was passed away at this early age of 127. Yeah.